you have the chance to win a Spring Super Sweeps from LAist. Donate $60 for one entry to win a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Check out all the other prizes too when you donate now at laist.com/sweeps.
Welcome to Air Talk on 89.3 KBCC. I'm Libby Denkman in for Larry Mantle today. Nearly 2 months since violent extremists stormed the U.S. Capitol on January 6th, new threats are prompting ramped up security in D.C. and potentially disrupting the business of Congress. The U.S. House of Representatives is not in session today. House leadership moved its business to last night instead. But House Speaker Nancy Pelosi downplayed the idea that a homegrown terrorist threat was stalling things. She spoke a bit about an hour ago.
I don't think anybody should take any encouragement that because some troublemakers might show up, that we changed our whole schedule. No, we just moved it a few hours, and it largely will accommodate the Republicans going to their own session.
Meanwhile, the Senate is going ahead with debate for President Biden's $1.9 trillion COVID relief package. For a better understanding of what is going on in Washington, we turn to the 33rd District in Los Angeles and Congressman Ted Lieu, who represents many coastal areas in Los Angeles County. Congressman, thanks for being on Air Talk today.
Thank you, Libby. Honored to be on the show.
So we heard Speaker Pelosi this morning say that moving House business was not entirely because of this QAnon or right-wing militia threat that we've heard about. What is going on? Is this a credible threat? And is the House responding to take precautions by not having a session today?
In the wake of the January 6th insurrection, law enforcement has to take all threats seriously now. And there was increase evidence that you had some of these extremist groups who wanted to attack the Capitol again on March 6th because they believe that's the real date of the inauguration. It's another one of their crazy conspiracy theories. And Republican leaders can reduce the risk of further political violence by just saying one simple, truthful sentence: the election was not stolen. Because they refuse to do that, we have to have National Guard troops and then alter our schedule to deal with these threats.
To the issue of the January 6th attack, there have been six congressional hearings on that incident, and it seems clear themes that are emerging. The Capitol Police were not prepared for anything like it. They were overwhelmed. These hundreds of Trump supporters laid siege to the building. There was a major delay in National Guard troops showing up to assist. Has anyone taken responsibility here, and who should be taking responsibility for what occurred?
There is one person who is the commander in chief. As soon as the former president saw what we all saw on TV, that there was an attack on the Capitol, all he had to do was make a phone call and the National Guard troops would have been there. Instead of doing that, he actually sent out a tweet attacking Vice President Mike Pence again, which further enraged his supporters who were attacking the Capitol to stop the Electoral College counting.
What do you think about the information we're hearing out of these hearings, though, about the delays that the National Guard had getting authorization to show up and assist what was happening at the Capitol? We heard Major General William J. Walker told the Senate's Homeland Security Committee yesterday that there was an unusual memo that arrived on January 5th that required him to get authorization from the Secretary of the Army and the Secretary of Defense to even authorize equipment to protect guardsmen. What more needs to be looked into, especially when it comes to what was going on at the Pentagon that day?
So we need to hear from the Pentagon officials. General Walker did say that as soon as he realized what was happening, he put in the request for National Guard troops. And we need to know why it took the Pentagon so long. At the same time, the former president was the commander in chief. He just had to make a phone call and it would have happened. And the former president did not do that.
Is there anything that has surprised you that's come out? Obviously, you were a manager of one of the most bipartisan impeachment processes in U.S. history. And I want to ask you about that in just 1 second. But is there anything that has surprised you or of particular interest that you want to highlight about the security reviews that have been going on since this January 6th incident?
I have to tell you, I was frankly surprised by Mike Pence's op-ed yesterday, continuing to perpetuate the big lie. It was this big lie that almost got him killed. And so I don't really understand what he's doing now, continuing to perpetuate the lie that somehow the election was stolen. It was not. Over 60 court cases that look at this, a number of them on the merits, and they've concluded there was simply no mass election fraud. Joe Biden won fair and square. That's why he's our current president.
And you're referring to this op-ed for the Daily Signal that the former vice president wrote, saying basically there were significant voting irregularities and things that have been debunked many times, part of the big lie that you referenced. On the subject of impeachment, you were one of the managers. We are still reckoning with the influence of former President Trump in the Republican Party and potentially for a 2024 election run. What do you think is the lasting impact of the impeachment process that you helped lead?
I think that our children and our children's children, when they read about the years of the Donald Trump presidency, they will know that he incited an insurrection. And that's what future generations will remember. And it's my hope that we can make sure such an insurrection never happens again. We had people die on January 6th. We had over 140 police officers injured, some seriously. And we just need to make sure we can heal our nation and ensure that we never have another violent attack on our Capitol.
On the subject of the COVID relief bill that has passed the House and is now moving to the Senate, what do you want to highlight about this bill? We did learn this morning that the Biden administration is okay with narrowing the income threshold for individual checks, the $1,400 checks that are going to go out if this passes and is reconciled with the House version. Is that compromise, that type of compromise, necessary to pass the bill? Because ultimately it means that some people who got checks during the Trump administration will not get that assistance under the Biden administration.
I oppose what the Senate did. However, we do have to get the bill through the Senate as well. And at the end of the day, it's still going to be essentially a $1.9 trillion bill that's going to help move America forward. There's really three main parts to this bill. The first is to help get more vaccines into people's arms and to deal with contact tracing. The second is to provide economic relief, such as stimulus checks, expanding the child care tax credit, increasing unemployment benefits. And then the third is to help schools reopen. And so those are sort of the three main buckets, as well as helping local cities not have layoffs of their first responders.
And we're going to talk about the Senate debate in just a minute here with Anna Edgerton, a politics editor for Bloomberg. Right now, I'm talking with Congressman Ted Lieu, Democrat, representing the 33rd District, much of coastal Los Angeles County. And he tweets at Ted Lieu, L-I-E-U. Congressman, what do you want to leave our listeners with when it comes to the scene in the U.S. Capitol today, seeing these temporary fences and extra guards around the People's House? What do you want to impress upon our listeners of what's been done since the January 6th attack and the business that you have still to complete in the House?
I served on active duty in the United States military because I believe our country is an exceptional country, and we still are. But I am deeply disappointed that we now have National Guard troops in body armor patrolling our Capitol because Republican leaders refuse to acknowledge that the election was not stolen and that Joe Biden is a legitimate president. If they would simply do that, we wouldn't need to spend taxpayer funds having all these National Guard troops around our Capitol. And they're even looking at extending their presence.
I mean, it makes me sad because I used to live there, and I know that one of the wonderful things about the U.S. Capitol is how accessible it is. You can walk right up to the visitor center on many days, and, you know, you have some metal detectors and security to get through the door, but it is very accessible for the public. Do you want to see things change and go back to, quote unquote, normal going forward?
Absolutely. And instead of having what you've described as accessibility, we've got this large fence and military trucks sitting at these entrances. I just never thought we would need our military to defend our capital against ourselves. And this is why we need Republican leaders to speak up and tell their base that the election was not stolen.
Congressman Ted Lieu, Democrat from California's 33rd District, thank you very much for being on Air Talk.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. And Congressional editor, politics editor, for Bloomberg, Anna Edgerton, is here with me. We are turning now to the Senate debate as this bill that's already passed the House, the COVID-19 $1.9 trillion relief bill. Senators plan to debate, and that debate actually might be going on already now that it's past noon on the East Coast. What should we expect this afternoon, Anna? What's going on?
Yeah, there are a few specific provisions that we're looking at. One, of course, is the rate at which the stimulus checks will be phased out. And part of that concern is from more moderate senators like Joe Manchin in West Virginia, who wanted this relief measure to be a bit more targeted, you know, kind of responding to some Republican criticism that it was just, you know, spreading stimulus money out too broadly in areas that it didn't really need to be going. So that's one of the provisions we're looking at. We're also looking to see what's going to happen with the amount of the kind of federal supplement for unemployment insurance. It was $400 per week in the House version. Some Democrats in the Senate have said it should be $600 per week. Others have said it should be $300. So we're looking to see what that amount ends up at.
And I guess, again, we have to look at Joe Manchin, one of the only swing votes that Democrats have to be concerned about, since they can pass most legislation, at least under budget reconciliation, with 50 votes and a vice presidential tiebreaker. Has Manchin tipped his cards when it comes to expanding this this unemployment benefit?
He's shown some flexibility. He said he thought it should be $300 because part of the concern is that you don't want to pay people too much money to not work. You know, there should be some incentive to look for a job, to go back to work, especially once the economy starts opening up and most of the population gets vaccinated. But it doesn't look like he's going to sink the bill over this issue. I mean, he wants to be a team player. He wants to get on board with this provision, but he also, you know, has a lot of leverage to raise very specific concerns to him. So, you know, he wants it to be a measure that he can go back and sell to his constituents in more conservative West Virginia, but he wants to vote for the bill. He's looking for a way to say yes.
Do we know what the income threshold will be for these $1,400 checks and how many people would be cut out of this version versus the people who got checks under the Trump administration?
So every individual who makes up to $75,000 would be eligible for these checks. The only difference is that it's going to phase out a bit more quickly. So, you know, rather than that amount tapering off into a higher income level, it's going to just phase out more quickly, which would cut out the number of people that get the checks. Now, some people have said this is going to leave some people who got checks from Trump not receiving checks from Biden, which seems like not a very smart political thing for Democrats to do. But, you know, Democrats have really tried to respond to some of this criticism that the package is too broad, it's too expensive, that it's more than is needed right now. And one kind of messaging point that we've heard from Mitch McConnell is that this isn't a stimulus bill for the end of the pandemic. That this is a stimulus bill that could have been defended at the beginning of the pandemic. But now, as the economy is beginning to open up, the kind of broad impact on the economy is not as impactful as some people had feared. This is more than is actually needed. Now, part of the problem in coming up with a policy solution to this is that the impact of the pandemic hasn't been evenly distributed. So you have some families who are working from home, saving money because they're out spending, they're not out spending quite as much. But then you have other families who are really impacted by this and who, you know, have lost jobs, have lost their sources of income, are cut off from support systems. So it's hard for policymakers in Washington to come up with the right package to address kind of a disparate impact in the population.
And I think you see regional differences as well in the way that this is being talked about, especially the minimum wage. This came out considering the different cost of living across the country. Clearly in West Virginia, it costs less to rent an apartment and feed your family than it does in Los Angeles, California, for example. And wanting to raise the federal minimum wage to a $15 level makes sense in many parts of the country. And some legislators in areas that are less expensive said it doesn't make sense here. Are we seeing a similar disparity conversation happening on these other items in the legislation? Of course, minimum wage didn't make it into the Senate version.
Yeah, that's going to be a consideration for any package that gets through, you know, not just on this issue, but, you know, on other issues as well. And that's the challenge of governing in such a geographically and racially and economically diverse country, that you have a lot of different priorities in different parts of the country and kind of realities that you're working with. So, you know, that's one challenge for Democrats who do have a broad coalition, that they have to write legislation for people in different parts of the country. That's the argument the Republicans use for a small government, you know, for less intervention from the federal government, for more support for the population coming from local levels. But, you know, the federal government does have a role to play here, especially in something like a global pandemic, because a lot of the impact in one state is going to impact the state beside it. You know, when you look at states like Texas that are already opening up and removing any mask mandate, removing any restrictions on capacity. And that has implications for surrounding states, for the whole country, because people, you know, of course, aren't going to stay just in Texas. You know, people move around, they travel, especially now as we're getting into warmer months and kind of a less cautious period for the pandemic. So, you know, in terms of setting policy prescriptions for the minimum wage, that's certainly a discussion to be had at different levels. But in terms of a response to a health crisis, a broad economic crisis, a global crisis, you know, that we're dealing with right now, there's certainly a role for the federal government in that.
The House version did not get a single Republican vote. Now, I think these questions about bipartisanship have been overplayed, and this theme, you know, that keeps coming up with the Biden administration about whether he's going to, you know, try to be bipartisan. It's been talked to death. But do you expect any Senate Republicans to decide to support this bill once all these changes are being made?
Yeah, I don't. I was just having a conversation with a Democratic strategist about this earlier. He seemed to think there was, you know, some hope that Susan Collins from Maine or Lisa Murkowski from Alaska could support this bill. But it's hard for Republicans to support it since they weren't part of the drafting process. Now, there's a reason for that, because I think the Biden administration learned from the Obama administration that you can try to work with Republicans all you want and you can try to bring them into the drafting process. But in the end, the support still might not be there. And they didn't feel like they really had time to waste on this since some of the federal unemployment benefits expire on March 14th. The Biden administration was working with a really tight timeline to work with Democratic allies to get this through Congress. So they didn't want to, quote unquote, waste time looking for Republican support. Now, that makes it a bit of a harder sell to the population. You know, it's easier to say we're spending $1.9 trillion that we arrived at on a bipartisan basis, rather than saying, you know, these are Democratic priorities that we think are important to the economy. It's easy for a Mitch McConnell to attack if Republicans weren't brought into that process. So, you know, there's a trade-off between expediency and kind of, you know, the bipartisan backing for a bill. And that's one that the Biden administration, you know, came down on the side of expediency in this case.
Anna Edgerton is politics editor for Bloomberg. And Anna, finally, I know that the shape of a budget reconciliation bill is a bit different than other pieces of legislation. Finally, for our listeners, can you describe, you know, some of the scenes that we're going to see in the Senate, like the Votorama? There's potentially going to be like a marathon reading of the text of the bill. What's this going to look like?
Yeah, there's a lot of Senate quirkiness that goes into this. And, you know, it's hard to explain to people outside Washington, but it's important because it shapes policy. You know, so the bill has now been through the birdbath, so to speak, to make sure that it complies with all this, quote unquote, bird provisions, BYRD, that kind of govern what can be included in a reconciliation bill that's not subject to a 60-vote filibuster. Now, like you said, that process, when we have the final version of the bill, it'll go through probably a full reading of the bill, which we expect Republican Senator Ron Johnson to request. That could take between 6 and 10 hours, and then it'll be subject to a voterama. That's unlimited amendments that can be offered on the Senate floor. So it should be a pretty late night, probably tomorrow night. That's going to give Republicans a chance to kind of press on some pain points, try to highlight some provisions that they think are wasteful. But ultimately, it will probably not do much to actually change the shape of the bill.
Who actually has to do the reading? This is what I want to know, because this is so much wasted time. Like, who is it? All Republicans who will be reading the bill out loud, or are they going to, you know, is there some way to force Democrats to do it as well? And who's going to have to, like, stay up late to do that?
No, it's a Senate clerk that does it. It's a, you know, these hardworking kind of parliamentary staff members who are there making sure that the Senate functions as a chamber. One of the Senate clerks is going to have to read the entire bill. Hopefully they'll take turns, because it's going to be quite a job.
All right. Tea and lemon and honey. That's what we broadcasters recommend for scratchy throats after speaking too long in public. So Anna Edgerton, politics editor for Bloomberg, and she tweets at Anna Edge, E-D-G-E, 4, numeral 4. Anna Edgerton, always a pleasure to speak with you on Air Talk.
Thanks so much.
Coming up, your COVID questions answered with our medical expert. A particular focus today on younger people and kids. School kids maybe going back to school in the relatively near future, at least in a hybrid type model of in-class learning. We want to hear from parents and from younger people. Maybe there are some high school students or younger listening to us, and talk about kind of the psychological effects of this pandemic, how you're feeling, how the distance learning has been going, and any questions you have about dealing with the stresses of the pandemic and returning to school. 866-893-5722 is our number. 866-893-5722 is our number here at Air Talk. I'm Libby Denkman, in for Larry Mantle, back in just a minute.
Support comes from Ciclavia, catalyzing vibrant public spaces, active transportation, and good health through car-free streets. Ciclavia promotes respect and infrastructure for bike and pedestrian-friendly public spaces. Enjoy these pop-up parks for the day in your favorite people-powered way. Jogging, biking, skating, strolling, or simply spectating. Free and open to all, Ciclavia Sundays generate miles of smiles in neighborhoods all over L.A. Details at www.ciclavia.org.